All right, man, I want to talk to you about this book, Andrew. I mean, Two Trains Running, I got to tell you, I've read all your books, and well, hands down, this is my favorite book of yours. And that's saying a lot, because you've written some damn good books, but I'm even going to go farther before I actually ask you a question. I think you've actually not only hit this one out of the park, but over the bleachers and right into that area of crime classics. You know, like, I think of Glass Key and Red Harvest and The Fast One. Man, you did it. And when you call it Two Trains Running, there's a damn good reason, because there's two tracks in this novel. Actually, I think there's more than two. I think there are several tracks running, because it's doing more than just telling you an entertaining story, although it certainly does that. But, man, it's got all kinds of things going on. And what I'm curious about, and some of these I know the answers to, but that's beside the point. What I want to hear you say, so we can talk about it, is why did you choose to go historical on this, and what drove you towards this project?
Well, it's the question of the right tool for the job more than anything else.
Yeah.
In terms of what I wanted to say, the content was much more important than the delivery method. I wanted to talk about the fulcrum, the place of leverage from which I think got us to the present day.
Oh, yeah. That's in here.
In all the areas that I care about and you care about.
Oh, you bet. You bet.
Well, you couldn't really set such a book in the modern day, because then you'd be doing the whole book as a flashback. So I wanted to do it in real time, compress that time so that so much happens within the 2 weeks of the book. But by setting it in that era, you can sort of be in on the beginning.
Yeah, you know, there's so much in this book that I think too many people have forgotten or unfortunately never knew about, the kid that was killed, the black kid, Emmett.
Emmett Till
is
a name that no American should have forgotten.
Of course not.
But as you say, most Americans have never heard.
Well, you and I both went through this era, and we know what a weird and crazy and time it was, as well as a turning point, as well as that fulcrum you're talking about. But maybe you tell us just a little bit about Emmett Till. I know that it's just sort of, it's mentioned in passing in the novel, but its impact for the novel, at least for me, is extreme. And
right.
just give a little information about Emmett.
I remember the effect that Emmett Till had on me, because he was just a couple of years older than me when these events took place. What happened was, he was a black child, really. I mean, 14 years old, who was born and raised in Chicago. But his mother had wanted to send him for the summer, which was the practice at the time, to stay with relatives. And those relatives happened to be in Mississippi.
Yeah.
Apparently, while he was in some sort of, convenience store, a small little grocery, a white woman entered. Whether he said something to her, whether, as was popularly reported, he wolf-whistled her, no one ever knows. But he was lynched for it.
Yeah.
He was taken out of his home in front of witnesses. There was no attempt to hide this. He was taken out of his home. He was tortured. And then he was killed.
Brutally. Brutally.
Well, his body was shipped back to Chicago. And his mother actually had an open casket funeral, because she said, I want people to see what they did to my boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, while the country was being just galvanized by this, two people were arrested in Mississippi for the crime, and they're acquitted in about 15 minutes. Well, even that, as grotesque and ugly as it was, would not have sufficed to really shock this country. But what happened after that was a journalist, his name was William Bradford Huey, actually went to the two people who'd been acquitted, and he said, look, under our law, you can't be tried twice for the same crime. Why don't you tell me what really happened, and I'll pay you this piece of money? Well, those two human beings, and I'm using the term really advisedly, described in very intimate detail exactly how they tortured that boy to death.
As I remember, too, there were photographs of these happy guys. It's been a long time, but as I remember, there were photographs of them looking kind of content with themselves.
Oh, they were thrilled with themselves, because they thought that they'd end up being heroes. Actually, what happened was the town kind of turned on them after that because of the disgrace that they brought to it. It's one thing to wink at a lynching, but it's another thing to blatantly admit you did it.
Yeah.
Which is what, in fact, happened. Now, there's many people, and you can count me as one of them, who's not remotely convinced that they were the only two people involved in the crime.
Yeah.
This crime was that proverbial boulder thrown into a quiet pond. Because
oh, yeah.
The reverberations are still being felt as we sit here and talk today.
Well, your book is about those reverberations.
Yep.
And I didn't want to focus maybe too much on this one incident, but I think it's important that people realize that this isn't just something that you made up for this novel. As much of this novel is based on real events and the things that were really happening. And it saddens me that so many people have forgotten or want to forget. And because if what I see now are the kind of tendrils and roots that are growing that are recreating a situation not too unlike this, if I'm not being too alarmist. And I think that this book is extremely important, not only as a great novel of crime, it's moved over into that ballpark, things like, you know, like I said, Red Harvest and Maltese Falcon, that certainly can be called crime novels, but it's also moved over into that area of crime classic, which means it's also of literary and historical and journalistic intent, which is one of the things you call yourself, sort of an investigative journalist writer. I don't know if that's the exact term, but something like that.
It's close enough. I mean,
yeah. Well, what is the exact term you use?
Well, I don't use it.
Or Sonny Mehta, I think.
Sonny Mehta coined it, and the term he used was investigative novelist.
Yes, that's a good term. Yeah.
Because the idea is that you can certainly use novels, quote, fiction, unquote, to tell the truth.
Without a doubt, what you've done here.
Well, here's what we did. We take actual facts about which there's no dispute, events that everybody knows occurred.
Right.
Then we take facts that did occur that are not as well known as they should be. And
like
in a way, it's kind
business.
Of a shame they're not.
Yeah. Well, the Al Capone thing, I was wondering, was that speculation on your part, or is that a real strong rumor, or how was that? Although he's, again, not a main character, it's something that's important because all of these things have to do with the pulse of the novel, meaning that that not everything is as it appears, and that things sometimes that appear to be done for good reason or positive reason often have negative consequences.
Well, let's look at the Al Capone thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond dispute that when Al Capone was first arrested, he ran the Cook County Jail.
Mm-hmm.
He was having Chateaubriand and champagne in the jail. They gave him a whole suite of cells, and he publicly embarrassed the government. When he got, because he bragged so much that he made a deal, the deal was withdrawn, and they tried him in federal court for that tax evasion. He got sent to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. Well, he proceeded to run that penitentiary, too. So now you have a government that's truly embarrassed. So you might say to yourself, well, maybe he could just be killed. But killing a man like Al Capone by shooting him or stabbing him or blowing him up just makes him a bigger, more mythological figure.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you humiliate a person with his kind of power?
Mm-hmm.
Well, miraculously enough, Al Capone ends up with syphilis. Now, it's a known fact, everything I said so far is true, that he ended up with syphilis. It's also not very well known, but a fact, that when Al Capone was released from prison, not when he was sent, released, he was only 40 years old, Joe.
Yeah.
So he was in his prime. He could have certainly returned, but he returned as a helpless, drooling, doddering cripple who had paresis, which is syphilis of the brain.
Yes. Yeah.
And he could not have been a more pathetic, degraded figure. So now we take another fact that is a fact, but not as well known as it should be, which is the Tuskegee experiment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, going back to the 1930s, the United States government deliberately allowed a select group of black males who had syphilis to believe they were receiving treatment, but did not treat them at all, because they wanted to use them literally as human guinea pigs to test the long-term effects of untreated syphilis.
Yeah.
And now here we've got Al Capone showing the long-term effects of untreated syphilis.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I guess that's a speculation, because in the book I explain exactly how he certainly could have been infected with it by government intervention.
Yeah.
Am I asserting that as a fact? No. Do I believe it plausible? Sure.
Yeah. So this is a case of taking things that are definitely historical, Emmett Till and then Al Capone, which we know died of syphilis, but bringing in some speculation, too. But speculation that's not just pulled out of your hat. stuff that's based on possibilities. And, you know, one of the things for me, the best thing about this whole book is the character of Debt. Like, and I'm sure that that's like D-E-B-T as well.
That's how you say it,
yeah.
Sure.
But one of the things that about him is that when I first started reading him, he was almost like this, this simple cipher at first. Like, it reminded me a little bit of Raven in This Gun for Hire by Graham Greene. But then you start getting these little bits and pieces, and you go, man, there's something going on with this guy. That's something else other than what you see. And of course, I'm not going to say too much, but what I will say is that we get these layers like an onion. It just keeps unwrapping, and we find out more and more about Debt, and we see how complex this whole situation is that's going on and that he's involved with. How did you come up with a character like that? Is he based on someone, or is that, I just can't imagine that, purely out of your imagination? I shouldn't say that as an imaginative writer, but he just seems so real to me.
Well, the truth is he is intended to be representational in every way. And what he represents for me is, as his name says, Walker
yes.
Dead is a dead walking.
Yeah.
How violence touches and permeates people to the point where it cannot be just played off. You know, the movie image of, you know, the serial killer, the sociopathic murderer.
Yeah.
The truth is, most people who engage in violence, as Det did early in his career, which we're not going to talk about because it's relieving too much.
Yeah, yeah.
It profoundly alters their chemistry.
Oh,
it alters the way they see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, if you want to make things right, you got to do a whole lot of wrong.
Yeah.
And for me, I've known plenty of people like Walker Det, but never one with this degree of ability to explain himself.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating character, and this won't give anything away, but some of the things I thought were so interesting was how meticulous, how methodical, and even the way he eats. I just thought, man, this is fascinating, his approach to how he eats and to what he eats and to the things that he does when he's alone in his room. I was fascinated with all of that, and I kept thinking, man, were you writing and just suddenly the inspiration came for this, or was that aspect of his character based? There's a thing where he eats these soda crackers.
Right.
You remember what I'm talking about?
Oh, I totally remember what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I sometimes forget my own books. But, tell me a little bit about all that, how you came about all those little mannerisms and those things that made Walker Det gradually become more than this cipher and become this deeper and more interesting character.
Well, again, without giving too much away.
Well, sure.
You know where he actually learned all these methods of relating to himself and his environment was during that time he spent in the swamp.
Yeah.
He learned from a person who knows.
Yes.
It's actually ancient wisdom passed on.
Yeah, I actually recognized a lot of that.
Sure you did. I mean,
because that's where I'm from.
Not only that, not only are you from the area and have you heard this stuff all your life, but as a martial artist of your standing, you get the whole concept of needing to be in balance.
Yes.
And what disruption of balance can do to an opponent.
Well, Det himself is dealing with a disruption of balance.
Yes.
And that he is gradually, and again, we go back to the fulcrum. We don't have to talk too much about what he's doing and how he's trying to balance things. But this fulcrum is that there's this whole thing in martial arts, and I know you know this too, it's about maintaining center. And if you lose that center, you start to wobble.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean that emotionally, although it can apply in many ways. But certainly, this is what Det struck me as doing, is that he's trying to find center again.
Yeah, he actually believes, as is revealed in the book, that if he does what he promised and he serves that sentence that he's been given, that he can actually be in his own center and get the reward that he was promised.
Yeah, it's almost biblical without the theocracy.
Yeah, I mean, he's a religious man. There's no question
yes.
about that.
Yes, no doubt about it. He has developed his own, and you use this loosely. You see this all the time in Private Eye novels, that he's got a code, and then the character, therefore, the rest of the novel does nothing that has anything to do with the code.
Right.
But this guy maintains a code. You may not agree with this code. You may not even come out saying, I totally understand his logic, but there is a logic to what he does, and it makes perfect sense. It certainly makes perfect sense to him.
If you accept the premise that he accepts,
yeah,
then all his conduct makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, and remember, he has some reinforcement because one of the things that he was promised actually occurs within the 2 weeks of this book.
Exactly. That's exactly. Well, you know, one of the things, too, that I liked about the book, not only, of course, Walker Dead, I mean, whenever he wasn't on stage, I was enjoying all the other characters, but I kept thinking, gosh, I had to get back to Walker Dead here. And of course, that's one of the beauties of the novel. It's got all these short, quick chapters, but yet they're so dynamic and they're so full of you know, rich texture. You'll have this little piece in there that may be like 3 or 4 paragraphs long, but it is so tight. It's not just two guys talking to fill space. You're giving us information all the time. And one of the things I really, really love were the black characters who worked in the hotel, and I find that to be so true that people find, or especially in that day, and I think to some extent, unfortunately, they still find a lot of people who work in those kind of jobs as just being sort of basic and simple. And in those days, a black man, especially, and I think it was true of the women too, but especially of the men, had to pretend to be someone else, in a sense. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the duality of those kind of characters, for the simple reason, not only is this a book that deals with all kinds of duality and different trains running, but it also helps set the time frame and how people were at that time, and how all this led up to certain moments that, of course, you're leading up to in the novel.
Many, many people in this book had virtually parallel lives.
Yeah, oh, they all do. And that's what's amazing about this.
And if I did the book perfectly, what I've given you is a real fast rushing river, and you don't just get to ride the raft, but you get to see the undercurrent.
Yeah. Well, you know, you said something to me once. We were talking about the cover, which I had seen, and I said, man, I love this cover. And you said, well, I really like it because it's got a train running, and underneath it you see this bridge and a car, and you got something else. And I said, yeah, but you also got the water in front of the car. And in many ways, that's it, because you not only have more than two things running, you have the reflection of all of those things running and all the things that are going on. So when these people have to act a certain way, and I'll let you get back to that. I'm sorry I interrupted you. But it has impact. It is, like you said, throwing that rock on the pond and starting those ripples.
Well, if I don't get my goal, which is that people will read this book twice, I'll be really disappointed.
I read it twice.
Yeah, I just think, let me tell you, I put more effort into this than the sum total of probably everything else I've written. And it took me longer, because just balancing, I mean, I had walls covered with charts just to keep the characters, you know, pure throughout.
Yeah.
Because there's no room to slip.
Really? I was wondering about that.
But see, if you look at purity, if you look at people being themselves, who got to really be themselves? They only get to be themselves when they act. So whether it's Rufus.
That's right.
Who by day is this servile sort of hotel boy, but by night is really what he calls himself, a new black man.
Yeah. But well, Moses is an interesting character, too. I believe that was his name.
Moses is, you know, again, not named accidentally.
Oh, of course not.
But he's the elder that they'd all been waiting for. But that you can be true even if you're bent. Because if you look at Carl, again, I don't want to give away too much.
Yeah, we don't go there too far.
But you can't be any truer than Carl was.
Well, there is that.
You know?
Yeah, he accepted totally.
Yeah, he did. He could not have been truer, because he took his heart out and put it on the plate.
Yeah. We don't want to get too far into stuff that people can't know anything about, but just to say that Carl's a major character in the book, maybe not as major as some of the others, but to me, he is one of those trains that's running, and it's important that he do the things he does, which I think fits in with showing how the country was changing and all the things that were going on. And one of those things is, like I thought about, you know, you talked about prohibition and the anti-pornography mm-hmm. things that were going on, and how that those have a duality unto themselves. And if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I think this too fits into the framework of this novel, and not only those times, but certain aspects of that fit now.
Well, I think that's exactly right.
It all does. I mean, it all leads up to the present.
See, and that's the thing. If the novel works, then the way I'm going to measure that is when people are done, they say, you know what, I need to go back and take a look at things I've been told.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And maybe I understand now that there's something beneath the surface. I'm not talking about conspiracy theories.
I know what you mean, yeah.
You know, I'm talking about there is an undercurrent. And if we don't look at the undercurrent, then we're just, you know, a chip going down that river.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're not steering, but we have that illusion that we are.
Yeah, we're sort of wild at the wheel.
And this country right now, and this isn't the place to have the discussion, but this country right now clearly is making a turn.
It really is, and this to me is a fulcrum going on right now, and it's going to be, we got to decide whether we want to use it for good or bad. Right, the thing that I enjoy too about this book, Andrew, and of course you and I have discussed this before, is how people can use buzzwords like patriotism and decency and things of that nature to do things that have absolutely nothing to do with patriotism or decency.
If you don't question what the words mean, if you give other people the power to decide those definitions for you,
yep,
you've given it all up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if, again, this era, all you had to do was point and say somebody's a communist.
Well, we're kind of having some connection to that now. I don't want to get too far into that. As you said, this is probably not the place for that discussion. But in one way it is, in that this book is not merely, oh, let's read about how the past was, because this isn't just a novel about the past. It's a novel that there's a period in time where we had to make a choice.
Uh-huh.
And this choice was made. And that choice has echo even unto now. And that now we're at another crossroad, so to speak, and we're at another fulcrum. So it's up to us to make this decision, hopefully a good one.
Well, that's exactly it. That's the perfect way to end this, because that's my goal, that people stop being so damn passive. I'm not talking about the fake cynicism you see like in movie reviewers.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people who just accept things as face value, especially in an age, because this book is an ode to journalism.
Yeah, we need real journalists.
Exactly.
Back.
You know, I would love it if my nephew Keith read this book and said, you know what, this is what I want to do. You see?
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. And believe me, it will be in his hands shortly. I just got to say something else. Are you going to be doing more work of this vein? And when I say that, obviously I don't mean necessarily of the same time or whatever, but books that are somewhat outside your series, which I'm certainly not suggesting you give up. Burke's series I love, and you have so many fans for that. But this, Andrew, is not just a different book in your list of books. This book has put you, I think, over in, if you'll pardon the pun, a pantheon of writers that all of us would love to do. And if you weren't my brother and I wasn't so proud of you, I'd probably be a little jealous. This is an amazing book, and I just can't tell you how proud I am of you. And I'm wondering if you're going to be doing more of this or what exactly your plans are.
You know what, brother? Here's the thing. I'll just be honest with you. This is my Sunday punch. If the other guy doesn't go down behind this one, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know you better than that. You've got another punch and another and another and another.
Bless you.
Yeah.